reading is a private act, but it puts you in touch with so many others, and not just in your own little community, though that's a good thing, but it stretches you back across time. You think, oh, other people have thought like this, felt like this, experienced this, been this. I get it. And I think the chief vice of modern life is this isolation masquerading as community. You're sitting at home with your laptop looking at conspiracy theories. It's not a community. It's people isolated in their terror. Reading does exactly the opposite. It brings you together in real freedom.
It's Shelf Life. In this episode, A Haunting We Go, with the author, Jeanette Winterson, who has just published a collection of ghost stories. And we'll discuss Italo Calvino's conjuring trick in his 1972 book, Invisible Cities, in which Marco Polo beguiles the Kubla Khan with a series of vignettes of journeys through cities fantastic and spectral.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Congress passed a bipartisan bill last week designed to make housing more affordable, but President Trump refused to sign it into law until Congress approves the Save America Act, legislation to impose voting restrictions that does not have bipartisan support. House Speaker Mike Johnson told Fox News today he thinks the president will change his mind.
I'm going to send the bill over to him. It's passed by both chambers. I'm sending it to him on Monday, and it will become law. And I certainly want him to take the biggest, boldest marker that he has and do that big Trump signature proudly on that legislation, because we're delivering for the people, and that's what he wants to do.
But if the president still doesn't sign it, it would become law in 10 days without his signature, as long as Congress is in session. Several large wildfires are burning across the western United States. Three firefighters were killed in Colorado yesterday. Colorado Public Radio's Stina Sigg reports two other firefighters were injured in a blaze that's grown to more than 40 square miles.
The U.S. Wildland Fire Service has released few details on the deaths and says it's focused on supporting the loved ones of the firefighters. They died in a rugged rural area along the Colorado-Utah border, where many smaller fires have merged into one. Governor Jared Polis has declared a state of emergency. Farther south, another Colorado wildfire forced evacuations and closed a vital highway Saturday. Much of the state is facing elevated fire risk and is in a major drought, following its lowest mountain snowpack level on record. For NPR News, I'm Stina Sieg in Grand Junction, Colorado.
Iran carried out a series of drone and missile attacks on Bahrain and Kuwait overnight, responding to a new round of U.S. airstrikes on Tehran. Speaking through a BBC interpreter, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi called on all parties to abide by the memo of understanding signed with the U.S.
Any attempt to adopt new or separate arrangements from those currently being implemented by the Islamic Republic of Iran will only complicate the situation, delay the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, and raise the level of tension, as we witnessed over the past two nights with incidents in the Strait of Hormuz that led to increased tensions and clashes. I urge all parties not to interfere in the management of the Strait of Hormuz or in the arrangements being made by the Islamic Republic of Iran to reopen the strait.
Iran says any challenge to its control of the Strait of Hormuz will jeopardize the reopening. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said today Ukrainian drones struck Russia's oil and military infrastructure again, in an effort to reduce Russia's ability to continue its war against Ukraine, now in its fifth year. This is NPR News. The search continues in Venezuela for more than 68,000 people reported missing after twin earthquakes last week. More than 1,400 people are confirmed dead. More teams from overseas have joined rescue efforts. Comedian Mel Brooks is celebrating a major milestone today. NPR's Bob Mondello has details.
He's turned 100, which still makes him a spring chicken next to the character he and Carl Reiner made famous.
2,000 years old. Is that true, sir?
Yes. You want to see my driver's license?
No. The 2,000-year-old man had seen it all, and so had Brooks in his movies. In History of the World Part 1, he was Moses.
Has given unto you these 15... 10... Ten Commandments!
He played the lead in his spoof of Vertigo and even sang the title song.
Hi-yang, anxiety.
And after creating Get Smart for TV, writing and directing 11 feature films, and turning two of them into Broadway musicals, the 100-year-old Mel Brooks has another movie on the way.
Spaceballs, the new one, is just like the old one, but it's newer.
Look for that in 2027. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
NASA is planning a mission to keep an aging telescope from crashing to Earth. The Swift Observatory, launched in 2004, has been sinking faster and faster because of intense solar activity. NASA will send a space robot to boost it into a higher, more stable orbit. The robot's about the size of a small refrigerator and has three arms with finger-like pinching grippers. It could be launched as early as this week and reach the telescope in about a month. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bloomsbury, publisher of Courage Can Save Us by Marine Corps veteran and social entrepreneur Rye Barcott, a call to courage and public service for America's 250th, available wherever books are sold.
Reading is a private act, but it puts you in touch with so many others, and not just in your own little community, though that's a good thing, but it stretches you back across time. You think, oh, other people have thought like this, felt like this, experienced this, been this. I get it. And I think the chief vice of modern life is this isolation masquerading as community. You're sitting at home with your laptop looking at conspiracy theories. It's not a community. It's people isolated in their terror. Reading does exactly the opposite. It brings you together in real freedom.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin.
Hello. Jeanette Winterson was in her mid-20s when Pandora Press published her debut novel, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, heralding a confident and daring new voice in English fiction. One that wasn't afraid to take risks in the service of craft. In the books that followed, including The Passion, Sexing the Cherry, Written on the Body, and more recently, Frankenstein, A Love Story, her playfulness and curiosity have remained boundless. I am an ambitious writer, she has written. I don't see the point of being anything. No, not anything at all, if you don't have ambition for it. Now Winterson has brought that flair for invention to the ghost story in her new collection, Nightside of the River, in which her fascination with AI and technology finds synthesis with her high romanticism and a childhood steeped in religion and its associated terrors. We'll also talk about one of Winterson's literary touchstones, Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities, an otherworldly act of fiction in a class all of its own. Jeanette Winterson, welcome to Shelf Life.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm very happy to be with you today.
Wonderful. Well, I love seeing you there with this wonderful, glorious background of an English country garden. I want AI to help me just step through my computer and join you there. But I was at college when your debut novel, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, was adapted by the BBC. That was in 1990, and it was a genuine cultural event, but in large part because of its frank depiction of same-sex desire, which felt radical for its time. It won a BAFTA for Best British Drama. It won you a BAFTA for the screenplay. You were 25 when the book was published. I wonder how its success changed your life.
Well, it's 40 years since Oranges was published, which astonishes me. You know, you look back at life, you think, what happened in between? I didn't realise that it would have the impact that it would have, because we never do. You know, we're in the midst of our lives. We're living our lives. We don't see the future. We only see where we are. It was very important to me to get away from the, as you say, the closeted, shameful idea of same-sex desire. I couldn't understand why, especially when in the Bible we read God is love, that we would want to limit that love. When humans find ingenious ways every day to hate and torture one another and ruin everybody's lives, we then try to prescribe love and to say it's this and it's not that. And that seemed to me to be insane and hateful. So I wanted to write something which would tell the truth about same-sex desire, but that would also speak across the idea of heterosexuality, homosexuality, into a place where we've all been, where we feel not understood. We can't talk to our parents. The older generation doesn't get it. We feel that we have to have secrets, hide away. All of that is real, whoever you desire. And that's what Oranges also wanted to speak to. I didn't want it to get stuck into one place, although I wanted to tell the truth about that place. I wanted it to go out and reach any young person or any person who had ever felt they had to hide themselves in some way.
It's interesting you say that, because I felt all the way through your new collection, which we'll talk about in a second, Nightside of the River, that sense of the universal is very potent, very present, no matter what the gender identity, the sexual orientation of the characters. It's all in there. I mean, every sort of type of human experience is sort of expressed there. But that sense of sort of aiming for something that can speak to all has always been very central to your work.
Yes, I think we have to look for what doesn't divide us. And sexuality has been used dishonestly to try to divide people. You're heterosexual, you're homosexual. That's not the case, because people's emotions, they're wanting to be loved, they're wanting to be understood, not to be betrayed, to be recognized, to be met. That happens, whoever it is that you want to be with. And when I call it dishonest, I call it dishonest in the sense that we should not separate humanity one from another by using these false weapons. You know, we can be separated, perhaps politically, perhaps by race or class, gender even, but certainly not by sexuality in that way, because the feelings are common to all, and anyone who had ever fallen in love knows exactly what that's like.
I wonder if you were advised at any point not to publish this book as a debut, if people felt you were maybe taking a risk that it would be misunderstood, that it would be seen as very much niche fiction.
Well, I think to start with, it was seen as niche fiction, because that's one way of trying to police somebody's work, and also to get it away and say, this is not important, don't worry about this. It's not for you, it's just for them. You know, it's a way of containing and silencing something that we find threatening. It's a kind of soft power way. You don't chuck it on the bonfire. You just say, oh, don't bother with that, it's not for you. So it's clever, and it's in its own way. And nobody really anticipated, including the publisher. It was only published in paperback to start with, not even a hardback. What would happen? Because in those days, in the 80s, you had little bookshops. People talked to each other, and especially in the gay community, word got out very fast. Here's something different, and you should all read it. You know, that was the Twitter of the day. Everybody told everybody what was going on. Much more of a town square than anything Mr. Musk could ever anticipate. And so it began to snowball. Much to the surprise of everyone. Suddenly it was there and it was in your face and there was nothing you could do. And that's when the BBC came along and said, well, should we do this? And again, they just gave us the money, left us alone, because they didn't think it was going to be that important. They were busy with some other big shows. Ours wasn't the big show. And then it just swept through the BAFTAs and off we went.
I had to learn that expression, water cooler TV, which meant that the show you would talk about the next day at work. You have been extremely prolific, but on the surface, at least, A Book of Ghost Stories, your latest book, might seem like a departure for a writer really associated with high experimentation. I wonder what was the spur for writing these stories in Nightside of the River?
Everybody is interested in the supernatural. Because death is the only hard boundary. You know the thing about we can't get away from either death or taxes. You know, well, the super rich have managed taxes, and they're working on death right now. But I thought to myself, well, it doesn't matter whether you believe or you don't believe. This is a fascinating topic, and everybody loves a ghost story. Everybody loves the idea that perhaps there is something beyond the now. And as a woman who was brought up in an ultra-religious Pentecostal cult, the idea of living on several planes of existence, and certainly among the dead, was very normal. And that's been the case for most humans for most of existence. We've always imagined that there are other planes of existence, whether it's angels, demons, spirits, elves, fairies, you name it. You know, we weren't alone here. It's only from the Enlightenment that suddenly we think, oh, we're on our own. And what's really fascinated me lately with the rise of AI and big tech is that for the first time since the Enlightenment, science and religion are asking the same question. Is consciousness obliged to materiality? And could we go beyond the body? I don't think I will live to see life extension or even the uploading of consciousness that people are working on, speculating upon. But of course, if consciousness isn't obliged to materiality, then everything changes. And I often did wonder, and in these stories it's there, was religion the only way that we could talk about this deep intuition that this was not actually the end, this was not the final answer, this was not where the story starts and finishes, that there would be something else? And some of these stories do deal with it, but they also deal with the ordinary human heartbreak of what it means to lose a loved one.
Mm. You wrote in one of these sort of interstitials that break up the short stories about some of your own experiences with the supernatural. You write about living in a Georgian house built in the 1780s, I think, in an old part of London, when you were woken by the sound of clattering footsteps on the stair, and then feeling a hand on yours. And at another time, you had this distinct impression of being haunted by your beloved friend, the late crime writer Ruth Rendell. I wonder if you could recount that story, because it illuminates a central thesis in this book, the way that grief kind of lives on after someone's death, but also the way that technology and the spectral are intimately acquainted.
I have a feeling that if there are spirits out there, they will like electricity, because I imagine that's what they're made of, because they don't have a body anymore, you know, which is one of the vexing parts of ghost stories and apparitions, because they always appear in clothes. And you think, why? You haven't got a body. But never mind. it may be so that we can see them, because I suppose, you know, we're a bit klutzy in Toy Town and they need to make themselves known, which must be annoying if you're as limited as we are. With Ruth Rendell, it was that she died, and we were very close, and we had been for many years. Since I was 26, I went to her house to write The Passion when she was already very established. And she's very kind to me all of my life, never judged me. She was the good mother. And soon after she died, I was sitting at my computer. I'm not particularly kind of, I don't have things open all the time, I'm not that kind of tech crazy. And all of a sudden, for a second, her face flashed onto the laptop. I mean, just full screen, and then it vanished. And it was real. Now, I do have that photo, and it is in photos in the file, but I wasn't looking at it and I wasn't doing anything. Anyway, the point is, it's one of those moments, as it so often is, when nothing is happening except you're thinking about a person, and then there is an event. It seems to just puncture space-time, and they're with you. And it did happen, and I can't explain it, and I can't forget it. But you know, one of the things about life now is that we can't explain everything, and sometimes you have to just put up with living with the discomfort, with the questions, with the non-explanations, and just say, do you know what? I don't know. I can't explain it, but I can't dismiss it. And I think many people listening today will have had similar experiences that they can't explain, but they can't dismiss.
Mm. I want to stick with Ruth Rendell, because I've always loved that idea of your friendship, an intergenerational friendship, a friendship between two women, two writers, but two quite different writers. I wonder if you could tell me about how she came into your life and how you ended up writing so many of your early novels in her garden.
Well, as a young writer, like many young writers, I had no money and I was living in a flat, and the person upstairs practiced the piano continually, and I mean continually, and he always made the same mistake in the same place. It was dreadful. So this made it hard for me to do any work, and we had the same agent at the time, and I was complaining bitterly that I couldn't get on with anything because of the piano playing, and she said, well, my client Ruth Rendell is going to Australia 6 weeks, and perhaps you could house sit for her. She has cats. Would you mind? And I thought, no, that would be lovely. Anyway, so it all began as a job. And then we met and we just got on and we liked each other a lot. We laughed a lot. She was a very intuitive woman, but also a perceptive, difficult woman and not easy to be with. And she didn't have lots of friends. But for some reason, we found a way to talk about things. She was very widely read. And I was rubbish at ever understanding crime writing. I could never work out who did it. So we had completely different minds.
You've sort of slightly anticipated my next thought, which was, given that the ghost story, in a sense, is so well acquainted with the murder mystery, and in fact, in your collection, some of these stories do involve murder. Could you imagine yourself sort of disrupting the murder mystery genre, sort of writing a genre book like that?
Unfortunately not, because, you know, there are some people who couldn't commit murder, but I'm not one of them, right? I could, and I would do it, and in some cases I wouldn't look back and I'd never tell anybody. But that's the whole problem, you see, it would be over and done with. So it wouldn't make much of a story. So that's a different mentality. Whereas Ruth was so interested in exploring and unwinding the growing confidence of people who commit crime. She said part of it becomes about contempt for others, and I don't have any contempt for others. I have anger and bafflement, but not contempt. And so because that's not in me, I think it's difficult for me to imagine it in somebody else. There are some things, even as a writer, you cannot get your head around. And for me, part of it is contempt.
It's interesting listening to you talk there about being angry. There were times early in your career where you were sometimes given a bit of a hard time. And I think one of your friends, it might be Ian McEwan, said words to the effect of, in England, success is always greeted with envy. And I wonder if you encountered a lot of that envy, and if you ever thought about, you know, perhaps as Martin Amis did, upping sticks and moving to another country.
Can you ever move somewhere else? I think it comes with you. I like living in England for all its problems, so even after Brexit, so I guess I'll stay and see it through. There was envy, and I didn't understand it. And I didn't understand it because, as a bookish child, I had naturally read all the fairy stories where the overlooked third child, who's just rubbish, wins the princess and the treasure and everything's fine. And I thought, hey, look, shouldn't I have won the princess and the treasure and shouldn't everything be fine, having come all this way? And the answer was no. And that was a shock. I didn't realise the level of vitriol, but also my politics weren't in place in those days. And this is really important. They just were not. My sexual politics were. I understood that. But I really didn't understand about the politics of class in Britain. And that no matter what Margaret Thatcher said, because she was Prime Minister at the time, this was not a meritocracy. This is not a place where people could seamlessly move up the ladder just because they were talented and worked hard. And I believed the myth. I believed the storyline. I got a place at Oxford, and I thought this is the beginning, and in many ways it was. And I thought that none of all those things would come in or come back or come to find me, and they all did. So it was a huge shock, and I guess it was the beginning of my politicisation, my understanding about class, about gender, about feminism. So I'm glad it happened, because if I'd had the golden elevator up Trump Tower, maybe I wouldn't understand any of this.
Your childhood was one of kind of coruscating trauma, as anyone who has read Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, your wonderfully titled memoir, will know. Your mother wanted you to be a missionary. I wonder if you ever gave that any serious thought.
I did, and it worried me, because the idea of going somewhere hot to convert the heathen was not exciting. But, you know, of course she did get her way, because I am a missionary, because I do want to change people's lives. I do want to change people's minds. I do want to convert them. I want to say that, you know, the life of the mind matters, that the imagination is preeminent, that it's not all about getting and spending, that it is something quite other, which of course preoccupies any of us who love books, who don't feel caught and bound by our physical circumstances. Perhaps she was right.
One of the revelations in Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal is that when you do eventually meet your birth mother, you sort of reject the idea that that would have been a better life for you necessarily, despite your adopted mother, who said frequently that the devil had directed her and your father to the wrong crib at the adoption center. You felt that that experience, that childhood, the one that you had had, in the end served you well. It gave you the foundation for who you are. And without it, you might not be someone who is able to see so clearly, perhaps, the world around her from the outside in.
I think that's right. Somebody asked me at an event what I would have been had I not been a writer. And the answer was immediate and clear. I said I would have been a criminal. I would, because my brothers were both criminals, my half-brothers, as it turned out. And they obviously didn't mastermind their businesses very effectively. Now, if I'd been around, I could well have taken over. And I could have imagined myself just running this criminal outfit from Manchester, and I'd have had a ranch-style house, and I'd be on my fourth husband and my sixth Range Rover with a jacuzzi in the backyard. I'd be in Bitcoin now, because my mind would have still been this mind, but it would have gone in a completely different direction. And when I think about that life, I think she did the best she could, and I've never... When I met her, I wanted to tell her that. I felt that she was trying to throw me clear of the wreckage because she was only 16. And what would have happened? I'd have ended up bringing up my two stepbrothers because the new man wouldn't have wanted to deal with me. And we'd have been in that place, that time. It would have been very difficult. There's a line in Why Be Happy talking about Mrs. Winterson where I say, she was a monster, but she was my monster.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking with the author, Jeanette Winterson. We're talking about her new collection of short stories, Nightside of the River. Jeanette, there is a wonderful story in Nightside of the River called Ghost in the Machine, which begins with this line, "When my husband died, I got to know him better." It tells the story of a woman who falls in love with a non-binary, nominally Cuban avatar, Ariel. The story is obviously fiction, but the premise is really not. I mean, elsewhere you've pointed out that if we can fall in love with teddy bears, and I certainly did, it's not at all silly to believe that we can fall in love with an avatar. I wonder if you feel that is the inevitable world that we're moving towards.
Well, already, as you know, you can get an app which will continue to send you messages from your dead loved one. It will scrape that social media profiles, and it's possible now to include dead people into photos that are taken contemporaneously so that they're just there at the party. It's crazy. And we're going to go further with that because, of course, if you have a metaverse, which isn't just about selling people stuff, in the metaverse, if you and your partner go in there as avatars and your partner dies in the real world, there's no reason why the avatar shouldn't keep going and you shouldn't have that other life continuing. So we're looking at some extremely strange outcomes via new technologies, and we don't know how they'll affect us as humans. I don't know what that does. I don't know what it does to grief. I don't know what it does to self-development. I don't know if we're then all stuck in the same stage forever. But it's a possibility. And, you know, in that story, it's simply that she has her husband as an avatar where they are in the alternative universe. But actually, she falls in love with this creature who was always a program. But they actually have a proper connection. And if we imagine that we will not have real connections with programs, I think it's naive. As soon as you start to talk to something and you think it's talking back, you cannot help but build a relationship with that entity, whether it's biological or not, whether it's alive or dead. And again, you know, as we were at the beginning, this hard boundary between life and not life is about to be disrupted anyway, because if AI becomes sentient or has consciousness, whatever that means, and it is not bound by our biological rules, i.e. it doesn't die. This is very strange. I mean, vampires don't die. And again, you know, we've been in that territory of having to live across centuries. What does it mean? What can it mean? Mary Shelley touched on it in Frankenstein, though we didn't know that's what she was touching on at the time. The idea of creating something or a being not subject to our rules with whom we have what we would call a relationship, it's going to happen. We need to explore this. And what a good way of doing it is in fiction. It always has been a good way of doing it. You know, in all the Greek myths, in all those stories where humans have relationship with gods or godlike entities, that is a way of exploring what it means to be in relation to a non-biological entity. So we've been rehearsing this for a long time.
On that note, ghosts do go back to Homer's The Odyssey, to the Bible. You have a section, an introduction to Nightside of the River, where you talk about some of your own favorite ghost stories. I wonder what you think are the ingredients for a good ghost story. What are the things you're looking for when you read one?
Well, the American ghost story is actually slightly different because it brings in the idea of the place as a player rather than just the backdrop where a situation happens, something like the Overlook Hotel, where the place itself in some way is complicit with the craziness in the person's mind, that these things happen simultaneously. It's not an innocent party walking into a haunted house or whatever. Everything is complicit. So that's always exciting if the place itself feels that it has some secret or some evil or at least some memory. But ghost stories are really quite simple, you know, if you think about them, because always something that happens and you think, no, that's just ordinary. That was just a coincidence. And the second thing happens and you think, maybe that wasn't a coincidence. And then the third thing happens and you think, ah! So in that sense, from a formulaic, and I use that word specifically, point of view, they're quite satisfying. And then, of course, when you realise that you're looking for that build until the reader or the viewer is convinced that something awful is going on, and at that point, all hell can unleash. But you have to get to that build. That's fun to play with because it does have rules. But like anything else, it's like jazz piano. You want to bend them and you want to work with them to create something that's a little bit different.
Mm. You often said that you're a glass half full person. And I'm really curious about that in relation to AI. There's a TED Talk, quite a wonderful TED Talk that you can find on Google, where you spend a lot of time focusing on what the story of being human is today. And the question you ask is, are we smart enough to survive how smart we are? The implication being that technology could destroy us or it could liberate us. And I want to ask you that question that you pose, maybe rhetorically, are we smart enough to survive how smart we are?
No, I am an optimist and I've always been an optimist. I always have to believe that there is a way through, and that's my strength and it's my weakness, and I'm really aware of that. So I'm still optimistic, but it's not the technology that's ever worried me. It's always been the human part of the bargain that's worried me, because we're greedy and mean-spirited and warlike, and if we cannot do something about these qualities which seem to be innate, then I don't know how we go forward with this new technology, which could promise unlimited abundance. This is a reset. I think it's an evolutionary jump that we could make now, because who said that our evolution inheritance is over with? You know, humans have only been around for 300,000 years. That's a salami slice of space time. You know, why have we finished? I'm sure we haven't. But whether we move forward at this point or whether we manage to destroy ourselves, then we have to start the whole damn thing again. Can you imagine? It would be so maddening to go back and start it all again from nothing. I don't know which way it's going to go. Because it's not just about how smart you are, is it? And of course, the people who are in tech at the minute are very smart, but in a very limited way. And I just think, you people have not read anything. You haven't thought about anything. You don't know anything about history, about philosophy, about religion. And you are in charge of the future. Give me a break. And that is the problem, you see, because they don't know what they don't know, which is nearly everything.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with the author Jeanette Winterson about her new book, Nightside of the River, a collection of ghost stories. Jeanette, you're a writer of books. How concerned are you that people read less and less, and the implications of that for being empathetic human beings?
I think self-reflection softens the heart in that it makes you more aware, more compassionate, more understanding. And the way we self-reflect, you know, vampires have no reflection, famously, do they? And, you know, the world's being run by a lot of bloodsuckers who just want to get everything out of us and have no idea who they are or what the world looks like beyond their own narrow goals. And that is frightening. And you look around now and you think, well, is it just psychopaths and sociopaths that, that get power, whether it's financial or political? And what do we do about that? And so it can seem as though this is a valiant rearguard action to say, look, the life of the mind matters, the life of the imagination matters. But that is why, you know, when you asked me to choose a book, I chose Calvino's Invisible Cities, which I know we're going to talk about, because at the end of that book, they're talking about the inferno of the living as something that's already here, and that the way to deal with that is to either accept it, just become part of the inferno, so you can no longer see it. And then the very end of the book says that the second way is to seek and to learn to recognize who and what in the midst of the inferno are not inferno, and to make them endure and to give them space. And I suppose if this is the inferno of the living that we're in now, then we never know who it is, what young person, what older person that we're empowering. These are chance encounters. It might be with a text, it might be with a piece of work that can change the way someone thinks, the way someone is, and we do not know what influence they will have. And that's why I guess I remain optimistic, because although humans are trained on data sets in just the same way that AI is, actually, you can have a change of heart and you can change your mind. You can see things differently. The world can open up to you in ways that were completely unexpected, simply because there's a disruption in your data set. And you think, well, I've just read this. What? I've just seen this, this theatre, this movie, this picture. Everything I thought was wrong, or I'm going to change my mind. You know, that's the kind of epiphany that happens very often in people's lives. You know, it happens in religious conversion all the time. We're used to it. People say, I completely see the other side now. But it happens through the agency of art, in that we see what we did not see. And that's why it is so important. It's an imaginative act that happens among humans for humans, and it always has. There's no evolutionary necessity for it, like growing food. We've always done art of some form or another. And so it's real to us, and that's why I hold on to it. And that's why I think that even now, in a world where nobody in big tech seems to read or care about the life of the mind, it's still worth us going on.
You've written at some length and in fact, narrated a BBC radio series on Manchester, this engine of the Industrial Revolution as a kind of touchstone for you. But you write in Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, I love the industrial north of England and I hate what has happened to it. I wonder if you can talk a little about what has happened to it in your lifetime that has deflated you so much.
But the Industrial Revolution, you think about it, was the world's first collective nervous breakdown, because you're moving from an agrarian society into something which has never been seen before, the coming of the machine. You know, and often people talk about all those 12-hour days in the factories. Well, on a farm, you always do a 12-hour day. So to begin with, it's not actually a cruelty. It's just what people know. This is how it is. It's a different rhythm. But when you bring that rhythm, the rhythm of the fields, into the factory, of course, it is dehumanizing and destructive and intolerable. And no one can manage. There were so many unexpected effects of the factory system, you know, but one of them was that for the first time, women came together. Before then, they'd either been doing little cottage industries or they'd been in domestic service. They didn't meet one another in the way that men did. But you put them in the factory system and they think, eek, we're working as hard as men. We can do this job. What's this business about us being second-class citizens and weak and we can't be paid as much? And of course, that is the beginning. Both of a political consciousness, a trades union consciousness, a feminism. Things start in unexpected places, even in horrible situations that you wouldn't wish on anybody, like the factory system. And, you know, the British writer Mrs. Gaskell said, I've seen hell and it is white. And that was what it was like when you opened the doors of a cotton mill. People were dying of lung disease in their 30s. It was grotesque. They called Manchester the Golden Sewer, because it made so much money and had so much misery. You know, and Marx and Engels went, and Engels looked at the people and he said, this is what happens when men regard each other only as useful objects. And now, of course, with AI, we say, this is what happens when men regard each other only as useless objects, as Peter Thiel and co. try to put everybody out of work. So, you know, there are huge connections between this 250-year period in our history, when we've changed the way that we live. And of course, in that city, which is full of energy, it is an alchemical city, it keeps reinventing itself. I love the energy. I love the way Northern people talk to each other. They laugh, they make jokes. Everybody's there. It doesn't matter who you are, whether you're a stranger or whether you're local. Everyone chats to one another. I like that interaction because I think humans thrive on it. So, you know, when I look now around me, not just in Manchester or in London, you know, in New York, Los Angeles, doesn't matter where it is, we see the same thing. You know, people terrified of one another, afraid to go out. You know, everybody ubiquitously with their headphones on, staring at their smartphone. And we are pulling each other away from ordinary interactions. That's the kind of thing I hate. And weirdly, I think reading a book, art, it doesn't separate you, even though it's a private act. Reading is a private act, but it puts you in touch with so many others, and not just in your own little community, though that's a good thing. And it might be a book club, or it might just be that you go out and talk about it, but it stretches you back across time. You think, oh, other people have thought like this, felt like this, experienced this, been this. I get it. And I think the chief vice of modern life is this isolation masquerading as community. You're sitting at home with your laptop looking at conspiracy theories. It's not a community. It's people isolated in their terror. Reading does exactly the opposite. It brings you together in real freedom.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Jeanette Winterson. We'll be back after this.
The road trip feels almost as American as apple pie.
America is created by travel. From the first pilgrims who arrive on the Mayflower and then start spreading out west, we've never stopped traveling.
But the history of traveling the country is both richer and more complicated than it may seem. I'm Amory Sievertson. Get in, we're going on a road trip. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Thank you for making Radio Catskill part of your summer.
Whatever you're doing, wherever you are, we're glad you have us with you.
Now, help keep us here for everyone who needs us.
Become a sound supporter by making a donation of $20, $30, $40 a month or more.
Or give a one-time gift of any amount. Support the news, music programs, and crucial information you rely on.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest is the author, Jeanette Winterson. We're talking about one of her favorite books, Invisible Cities, by Italo Calvino. Jeanette, in your 1987 novel, The Passion, Venice is described as a city of disguises. That's certainly true of Invisible Cities by Italo Calvino. It's a series of 55 vignettes of magical cities. Strange cities broken into sections, each of which is preceded and followed by a sort of commentary from Marco Polo, the great explorer, and the Khan. Perhaps we can start with what Invisible Cities means to you. In my copy, you're actually quoted on the back cover describing it as a book that you would choose as pillow and plate alone on a desert island, which is a wonderful image to conjure.
I've always wanted to get away from, for me, 19th century realism, not because I don't love those novels. I've read most of them and would read them again, but because I didn't want to write them. And I was looking at that time to a European tradition to find somewhere I could go that would be about imagination rather than experience. And with Orange is Not the Only Fruit, I had wanted to write about imagination. I thought I was using myself as a fictional character. And I started to look away from the Anglo-American tradition towards Europe. And I found Calvino. And he gave me permission. He gave me freedom. He gave me space. He gave me an example, a way forward in my writing so that I wouldn't get stuck, because it had happened to him. And his first novel was highly realistic, 1947. It's about a young boy who works for the resistance in the war, which Calvino had done. And then he threw away his next three novels because he couldn't write them. He says, I became aware that between the facts of life that should have been my raw materials and the quick, light touch that I wanted for my writing, there was a gulf that cost me increasing effort to cross. And I really understood that. And he solved it by sitting down one day and just writing what looked like a fairy story, The Cloven Viscount, which is about a count who gets blown in two by a cannonball and each bit of him lives separate lives, which was, of course, Calvino's psyche saying, hey, dude, you know, on the one hand, you're in the Communist Party and you're a social writer and journalist. And on the other hand, you're a fabulist who daydreams all day. What are you going to do? And the psyche began to heal itself, as it so often does if we give it a chance. And this gave me hope. And I thought, Jeanette, just go forward and write the book that you want to write. And that's what I did with The Passion in 1987. And yeah, I hadn't been to Venice because with Calvino, I thought there's no need to go anywhere. Just write about it. And when you've written the book, go and see if it fits. And so that's what I did. So for me as a young person, it was great freedom of mind. And, you know, one thing I hate now about the way we live, creative writing programs and all that stuff, even though I teach on one, is that it's very easy to turn writers into copies of other writers, to be too formulaic, too prescriptive, and not let the mind go into its playful mode and find out what kind of writer you actually are. And that's what I discovered in my private conversations with Calvino, who was dead. He died. He was about to give a series of lectures at Harvard, the Charles Eliot Norton lectures, and he died on the eve of delivery, which was really fateful. And if anybody wants to read those, there's a book called Six Memos for the Next Millennium. They're beautiful essays. But he died. I found him. And our best friends are dead. You know, we're back to this business of life and death, and is there a hard boundary? As a writer, as an artist, your best friends are often dead. It doesn't matter because they've left the work behind them, and that's where you can go to find help.
I wonder if you consider these cities to be metaphors for concepts around memory, desire, time, and how many of them are really based on the sort of real aspects of cities.
I guess I'm always fighting off being lost in the literal. And I don't want to be in that place. And, you know, my whole life has been the triumph of imagination over experience. So it's this balance between the fact that we are 3D creatures who must eat and sleep and do what we do and are bounded by time and will die. But we're also this hybrid thing, people who can dream and imagine. You know, it's a ludicrous position to be in. That we must wrestle with and manage, not the one thing nor the other, but this hybrid that we are. And so that's why I hold on to art, the imagination, because I think that's the way humans have managed the intolerable situation in which we find ourselves. Mm. The last line of The Passion is, I'm telling you stories, trust me. And that felt right to me at the time. Well, I was only 27, but it was very clear that that was the last line and that each part of that was important, that there were stories, but that you could and should trust me. Because what I'm really saying is just trust me as a conduit of the imagination.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking with Jeanette Winterson, author of Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, and more recently, Nightside of the River, a collection of ghost stories. Jeanette, it's interesting that those final two words of The Passion, trust me, because that brings to mind a warning that this novel begins with, Invisible Cities, about unreliable narrators. And trust me could also reference that, that Kublai Khan does not necessarily believe everything Marco Polo says when he describes the cities visited on his expeditions. This is narrative dream telling. You trust the narrator or you don't, but nothing is real.
No, it's not. It isn't. And in the sense that it is a product of the imagination. And what Calvino was really trying to push away these monoliths of both fascism and communism, both of which always get lost in the literal, and to say, surely there is a way of thinking, a way of being, you know, outside of these monoliths, because that's what he was growing up with as a young man. Fascism started so much earlier in Italy. It kicked off in 1922 and it wasn't over until the end of the war. That's a long time. And so whatever time you grow up in is going to shape the way that your mind works. And pushing against those monoliths, I think, was so crucial. just to say, please let a bit of light in, let a bit of lightness in. He loved the idea of quickness, of multiplicity, things that would rise above. One of his favorite metaphors was of Perseus fighting the Gorgon. And the gaze of the Gorgon turns everybody to stone. And Perseus is the only one who can defeat the Gorgon because he doesn't look directly at the monster. He uses the shield as an indirect means of vision. And Calvino was really struck with this because he thought, no, I must not look at life directly, life as she has lived. I can't write this social realist novel and tell you how it is now. I need to do something different and perhaps activate your imagination as a participant in this story.
Jeanette, we have a short excerpt from the audiobook of Invisible Cities, read by Richard Higgins. Let's hear it.
You walk for days among trees and among stones. Rarely does the eye light on a thing, and then only when it has recognized that thing as the sign of another thing. A print in the sand indicates the tiger's passage. A marsh announces a vein of water, the hibiscus flower, the end of winter. All the rest is silent and interchangeable. Trees and stones are only what they are. Finally, the journey leads to the city of Tamara. You penetrate it along streets thick with signboards jutting from the walls. The eye does not see things, but images of things that mean other things. Pincers point out the tooth drawer's house, a tankard, the tavern, halberds, the barracks, scales, the grocers. Statues and shields depict lions, dolphins, towers, stars, a sign that something, who knows what, has at its sign a lion or a dolphin or a tower or a star. Other signals warn of what is forbidden in a given place, to enter the alley with wagons, to urinate behind the kiosk, to fish with your pole from the bridge, and what is allowed, watering zebras, playing bowls, burning relatives' corpses. From the doors of the temples, the gods' statues are seen, each portrayed with his attributes, the cornucopia, the hourglass, the Medusa, so that the worshipper can recognize them and address his prayers correctly. If a building has no signboard or figure, its very form and the position it occupies in the city's order suffice to indicate its function. The palace, the prison, the mint, the Pythagorean school, the brothel, the wares too, which the vendors display on their stalls are valuable not in themselves, but as signs of other things. The embroidered headband stands for elegance, the gilded palanquin, power, the volumes of Averroes, learning, the ankle bracelet, voluptuousness. Your gaze scans the streets as if they were written pages. The city says everything you must think, makes you repeat her discourse. And while you believe you are visiting Tamara, you are only recording the names with which she defines herself and all her parts. However the city may really be, beneath this thick coating of signs, whatever it may contain or conceal, you leave Tamara without having discovered it. Outside, the land stretches, empty, to the horizon. The sky opens with speeding clouds. In the shape that chance and wind give the clouds, you are already intent on recognizing figures. A sailing ship, a hand, an elephant.
And that was an excerpt from the audiobook of Invisible Cities by Italo Calvino, read by Richard Higgins. I wonder, Jeanette, if you think there's a meta commentary or critique here on empire and expansion, since Kublai Khan's Mongol empire is so vast that he can barely experience it in person. He has to live vicariously through these elaborate stories that Marco Polo spins for him. Maybe he knows that his empire is doomed to collapse, as all empires do.
Well, that's a good question, and it's one that we're going to have to face increasingly, isn't it, about who owns what? You know, because capitalism itself is based on the next frontier. What can you conquer? What can you take over? What can you own? And we've really run out of stuff. So we're going to have to come up with some new ideas, and going into space, sorry, Mr. Musk, is not necessarily the right way forward for most of us. So we're at a failure of imagination right now, and that's what needs to be addressed, I think, most urgently. So we're back to, can the tech bros address this? Probably not.
Our cities have become much more uniform over time, certainly much more now than when Calvino published this book 50 years ago. I wonder if there's also a critique here of the sort of growing sameness of our cities. I mean, we can certainly never return to the time when the real Marco Polo went on his journeys. But even so, in a vanishingly small amount of time, cities have all seemed to become cookie cutters of each other.
Yes, I think he felt that. I mean, look, Calvino adored cities. He lived in Turin, Milan, Paris with his wife. He was a cosmopolitan writer, human. But he didn't want to live in the countryside. He wanted to live in the city because he loved the interchange, the exchange of human behaviour, and to be part of that, not just in the intellectual discourses, but just in the ordinariness of shopping, of moving around, of seeing people going about their business. And yes, that has been lost, but lost in a sense, we wonder, well, who's lost it? Because there are lots of young people now who know nothing else, who never saw cities when there were small shops and things were more individual. And back in the 60s, the likes of Jane Jacobs were saying, you know, if we don't protect our cities now, well, they're just going to be highways with malls off them. How right she was. And I guess I always put my faith in young people, because what I'm hoping is that as we begin to redesign our cities back to human scale, and I think there is a push to do that, you know, whether it's the idea of the 15-minute city where you can walk everywhere or bicycle everywhere, which is a lovely idea. If we could get away from this sense, this kind of urban dream, which began as the American dream, you'll just get in your car and go, well, maybe you won't. And maybe we can work around that again. So I'm always hoping that the human imagination will say enough already.
Jeanette, does posterity matter for you?
No, I think about it as the Indian rope trick. I'd like to just climb to the top of this rope and then disappear. And the best of me is there anyway. You know, I mean, again, back to this business of, you know, the not being lost in the literal, not everything can be explained by biography or biology. You leave behind this strange amalgam of circumstance and self-states that you are in your made and created work. And you just hope that somebody will pick one of these things up one day, and again, something that speaks to them. And to me, that's everything. And if I've done a little bit while I'm alive, and I think I have, because people come up to me in events and so on, and they write to me and they say that I've helped them in different ways, and that's wonderful. And if that can continue, so be it. But at the same time, the world is moving very fast. In acceleration and disruption, they're the buzzwords of our period. So, you know, it may be that I'm shoved off the end of the shelf much faster than I might have been in a different period. And that's all right, too. I mean, there's no need to worry about it. You know, we just have to hope that this story will go on in a sufficiently interesting way because other people want to tell it.
Jeanette, if you were to be cast away on a kind of desert island, but it had to be one of the 55 cities in Invisible Cities, which one would you most like to spend time in?
Do you know, I wouldn't, because what I really like to do is I'd like to get in that garden with Polo and Kubla Khan and the chessboard that they have, because they always play chess. And I'd like to sit there quietly to one side and be in that encounter. I think that's the hot seat of the story, isn't it?
Well, Jeanette, if I can find my way into that same garden, I'll sit next to you. Maybe we can drink some orange blossom tea and...
Is that all?
spiked with, I don't know, what are they, arrak?
A nice Pinot is fine.
do you think they had that in the 13th century Mongol Empire?
No, but we can import it. We can import it.
Jeanette, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for finding time to chat to me about one of your favourite books and the wonderful ghost stories in Nightside of the River.
Thank you.
We've been talking about Nightside of the River by Jeanette Winterson, published by Grove Press, and Invisible Cities by Italo Calvino, published by Mariner Classics. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books in collaboration with Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Lydia Millett, John Waters, A.M. Holmes, and Kevin Barry. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating? It can help others find the show.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeversinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, New York is the latest state to allow assisted suicide or medical aid in dying. We hear from the governor who made that happen.
I can't impose my morality on others. This is the foundation of our country, that you have free will and you can make decisions.
Who gets to choose a good death? That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
With Morning Edition from NPR News, you don't have to wonder where your information is coming from, because we tell you. Get your news straight from the source every weekday.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on Radio Catskill.